The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via video conference by Judge Greenberg and Judge Jaquith. We're here today for the matter of James M. Kearns versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 20-2365. Beginning with Secretary's counsel, please state your name and your appearance for the record.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Nicholas Esterman for the Secretary, and with me today is Megan Krall, Deputy Chief Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Esterman and Ms. Krall. And Appellant's counsel.
Good morning. Adam Luck, representing veteran James Kearns.
Thank you, Mr. Luck. Now, as you know, each party will have 30 minutes to present. Mr. Esterman, since you're arguing first, how much would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
We reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, and Mr. Esterman, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Judge, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The notice letter at issue here is not a final decision of the board, and I hope to start by providing some context in that regard. This case shows some of the changes brought on by the implementation of the Appeals Modernization Act, the AMA. One of those changes was the board being tasked with processing notices of disagreement, known as VA Forms 10182 or Board Appeal Requests now. Now, under the legacy system, the regional offices were tasked with processing NODs. And if an NOD was determined to be untimely, that determination could be appealed to the board, which could then be appealed to this court. But under the AMA, while streamlined, a similar process remains even with the board initially processing those 10182s, meaning that a claimant can seek review by the board of the board's initial determination on timeliness, and that review will yield a board decision that can be appealed to this court. With that in mind here, not only is the board's notice letter not a decision as contemplated by Section 7104 and 7252, but an appeal of that notice letter is premature because appellant had yet to receive an appealable decision from the board on the question of timeliness.
Mr. Esterman.
Yes.
So under the legacy appeals process, there was a regulation 19.34. And that's still in existence, but it applies only to legacy. And it specifically said that timeliness is an appealable issue. Any kind of timeliness issue. Now, I noticed that under, I didn't find a similar provision under the board regulations. Is there a similar provision?
Your
kind
Honor,
of a corollary to in the AMA process?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of a specific provision, and I admit I'm not very familiar with 19.34. I'm not sure it was in our briefings, but I note that 7105, I believe, does speak to. Excuse me, let me just consult my reg book here. But the 7105 governs filing of appeals, and subsection C says a question as to timeliness or adequacy of the notice of disagreement shall be decided by the board.
That doesn't clarify. I mean, your whole response to the your response line for a lot in response to a lot of the court's orders was your responses were like, this isn't a board decision, which is what you just said. But that's only because a board member didn't formally decide the timeliness issue. Now, I know you changed your letter, but are you saying that there is no corollary provision in the AMA as there was in legacy that provides that all timeliness issues may be appealed?
Your Honor, I would be happy to consult the regs and get back to you, but I'm not aware of a specific provision under the AMA regs in that regard. And just to kind of rationalize that, there were quite a few changes in the context of adopting the AMA. And, you know, what we view in the legacy system as a notice of disagreement and a VA Form 9 is essentially now merged, right, in the context of what we see in the AMA in the context of this 10182 form, right? We've streamlined that process so you don't have the statement of the case, you know, a veteran is able to kind of directly appeal to the board in a more streamlined fashion. And in that context, that might be why a regulation in that regard isn't there. But I would say the veteran still provided one right of appeal before the agency on this question. And that is kind of the basis for our argument here, is that the board did make this initial timeliness determination, and to directly appeal that to this court is essentially an interlocutory appeal. And
can I get a direct answer to this? So you pointed me to 7105, and it's 7105B1C, I believe, that you're referring to. Now, is it the secretary's understanding that the term board used in that provision means board member decision, a final appealable board decision, or does it just mean like a letter from Mr. Arnold, which is what Mr. Luck and Mr. Kearns had received in this case? So which is it? Can you verify or confirm to me that the secretary's understanding is that board in 7105B1C means final board decision?
That is my right.
That is your understanding. Okay. So why, explain to me why Mr. Kearns did not receive such a final board decision here?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the letter was issued on March 24th, 2020, and within a week, there was an appeal filed to this court. So there was no other attempt to contact the board, either by way of the instructions that were provided in that letter, which again has been subsequently amended for clarity, or any other type of informal attempt to contact the board and say, hey, on the face of this letter, this calculation, the timeliness was calculated wrong.
But this statute doesn't say like the veteran's going to have to reach out and ask for an actual decision. But you just told me that a question as to timeliness will be decided by the board, by a board member in a final board decision. So I still don't understand why that didn't happen here, and why it would have taken a further effort by the veteran to somehow try and extract from the board an appealable decision.
Your Honor, just like in the legacy system, there has to be a challenge as to timeliness, right? This was just the initial determination as to whether that 10-182 was timely or not. And so the extra step to seek. It's just one step shy of challenging that actual timeliness determination before the board, so you can get that final appealable board decision that we all commonly know that we see before the court regularly.
But you admitted, I believe, in some of your responses that there was no notice of appellate rights attached to that letter. So
absolutely,
how
Your Honor.
Was the veteran supposed to know?
Well, Your Honor, they could have challenged that letter in any other form that was delineated in the letter, but we do acknowledge that the letter, which was in an early version in the context of AMA, as the board was taking on this new process for the first time, was not necessarily clear on that point. So in that regard, the board has amended the letter to provide clarification that you can either seek extension, which is provided for by the regulations, you can seek a recalculation if you think that there is some type of calculation error, or you can more formally seek an appealable decision from the board. Now, in the context of a calculation error, right, if this was miscalculated, we recalculated it, and we determined it was timely, it would just get docketed, right? So an appealable decision on timeliness would really come in the context of when it truly is not timely, or there's some type of denial as to good cause for extension. This case does, I admit, fall in kind of a strange area because there was a miscalculation by the board.
And this letter told Mr. Kearns that his appeal was not timely. It said nothing about challenging that decision in any way. Just we reject your appeal because it's not timely. Well, Isn't that a decision of the board?
No, Your Honor. The letter says that your Terminated 2 is untimely, and therefore we cannot process it underneath the modern system. That's the exact language from the letter. And then it says, if you disagree with this letter, here are the two options you have. One is to seek an extension for good cause, or two, because this is a post-SOC opt-in, meaning the veteran was in the legacy system, made the decision to opt into the modern system, that there are still the ability to possibly file a Form 9 in the context of the legacy system and have their appeal processed that way. Now, for Mr. Kearns, you know, there's no evidence that he did seek that process, but he could have still filed, an untimely Form 9 and then, you know, raised some type of argument as to why that was untimely. But there were avenues provided to the appellant in the context of that letter, and, you know, if they had disagreed with the letter on its face. But I will say
not, you know, reasonably set out or effective ones.
No, Your Honor, we acknowledge that this was an early form of that letter. It has been amended to try to find that clarity for veterans. And you know, the board has been very willing to, you know, and understands that the AMA drastically changed the process for veterans and for VA. And then there are going to be slip ups here and there. And so, you know, the board quickly attempted to amend that letter. They've come up with a process to try to correct these decisions or correct these errors. And so we openly acknowledge that there were some flaws here, but ultimately our position is that this letter, the four corners of this letter, are not a decision as contemplated by the court's jurisdictional statute. And
Why not?
Well, as you said, Your Honor, the primary...
Just a minute. You keep repeating the same thing over and over again. Why is this not a final decision that we have jurisdiction to review? By the way, add to that, what if it's not a final decision? Can't we see that the right thing is done? Secretary doesn't seem to be able to get it right. Why can't we always intervene?
Well, Your Honor, let me take your first
question.
Your question first, Your Honor. There's two primary reasons why this is not a final decision of the board. The first is that there is another way for the veteran to challenge this before the board. That's his right to right of appeal before the secretary as contemplated by 7104, by 511, I believe. And so we would essentially be depriving the veteran of challenging this. And I think being able to fix this at the board level is much more, would potentially be easier in theory than to have to get all the way to the court. And
well, have you fixed it? Is everybody in the same position as Mr. Kearns been notified of the erroneous letter that they received? What's a veteran supposed to do?
Your Honor, everybody that we've attempted to identify that has had a miscalculation has had their appeal docketed as timely. But you're right, Your Honor, we have not been able to identify, as we noted in our pleadings, every single veteran that may have received a letter that was based on a miscalculation. But the board is attempting to do that, and that's why we've taken the actions throughout the course of this case to correct the cases where we've specifically have been identified and to provide notice to as many veterans as possible.
Well, just a minute. This is now 2022, end of March. When did this statute go into effect? This is a statute, by the way, that the secretary pushed very hard to get passed by Congress. Weren't you prepared to deal with the administrative activities and that were easily foreseeable under the new statute?
Your Honor,
how long is it going to take to find the correct method of advising veterans?
Just for clarity, Your Honor, do you mean the AMA generally? Or
yes. When was this statute enacted?
Well, it went into I can't recall when it was enacted, largely went into effect for us in February of 2019. But there obviously is a little bit of long of a tail until appeals under that system got to the board. You know, late 2019, early 20.
Yeah, but you should have been prepared for that, shouldn't you? Shouldn't the secretary have been prepared for this stream of appeals?
Well, Your Honor, I think as we both know, the system has been around for a very long time. This was a drastic change in how we handle appeals in an attempt to streamline the process for veterans to make this easier. And we openly admit that there are some growing pains in transitioning to.
But with respect, sir, do you hear yourself? This is a system that was intended to make it easier for veterans to appeal. And here we are 3 years later, and the secretary hasn't figured out who it needs to contact to make sure that an injustice isn't perpetuated. That sound like a system that's made it easier for veterans to appeal? Or do veterans need to come to us to be sure that the secretary is fulfilling the promise of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I admit that there is a transition here. We are trying our best to streamline this process. Congress, you know, laid out this framework to try to do this, and there are some growing pains, but I think we are ultimately achieving that desired outcome of streamlining the process. But to your point about whether the court can intervene, I think ultimately the court needs to decide the threshold question as to whether they have jurisdiction over this letter. That is the doorway to getting recourse before this court. And if there's no, the court finds that this letter is not a decision, as we've argued since July of 2020, I believe, then the court doesn't have the authority to act on any other basis. Whether that's the request for class action, whether it's ordering the secretary to provide any other type of remedial action. And everything we've done in this case is consistent with our position on that in that regard, and that we have just taken efforts to try to fix this because this is an error. Again, we're talking about a calculation error. And I don't mean to minimize that, but we're not talking about some gross misapplication of law. We're talking about an administrative professional at the board level who's miscalculated 60 days in this context. And while that's unfortunate, that's something that the board should be able to fix on their own, or the secretary should be able to fix on their own.
It's more than unfortunate. It deprives the veteran of his right to be heard. Isn't this the worst possible situation for a veteran? His or her case is rejected and not even docketed. So the veteran has no opportunity to get benefits, and no one even knows that he or she has been cast into the abyss unless the veteran appeals to our court.
Your Honor, I don't disagree that a veteran not having their opportunity to be heard is unfortunate. And in this context, these letters were sent in a limited time period, right? That's kind of identified in our notice. But because
200,000 of them. Isn't that the estimate? 200,000?
Just to clarify, Your Honor, we haven't been able to identify all of the letters, or excuse me, let me walk that back. 200,000 10-182s were filed within the time bounds of what the declaration spoke to. So it's not necessarily 200,000 veterans that.
Well, how about to the nearest 10,000? How many?
Your Honor, again, as the court's declaration said, that they're not able to identify this with any accuracy. But what I can tell you is, I can tell you if you're interested about the response we received to the notice and what actions we've taken in that regards. And in the 6 months that the notice has been out there, we received 15 responses. And that was a really, only five of those were actually purely untimely.
Well, yeah, but you put this on some sort of pigeonhole on a website. You didn't send out notices to each individual, did you?
You're right, Your Honor. We did not, because the board has limitations in being able to identify every single individual that received a letter based on a timeliness, or excuse me, on a miscalculation. As the board said in their declaration, not only would it be incredibly labor intensive, but because they would have to go through each individual VBMS file where a 10-182 was filed and then track down to see what type of letter was sent in response to the 10-182, I mean, I think there's that type of manual review is ripe for error in and of itself. And so this notice was attempted. It was an attempt by the board to try to capture this as many veterans as possible, as quickly as possible, because we don't want these issues to linger. And again, I hope that our actions show here that we have tried our best, given the constraints that the board has noted, to try to fix this issue for veterans and veterans that received a miscalculation response to their 10-182.
But the remedial efforts don't have any effect on our jurisdiction over the March 24, 2020 letter, do they?
No, Your Honor. I think it just shows that the secretary and the board are taking this issue seriously, and we've acted consistent with our position here that the court doesn't have jurisdiction. So it's not that we have not acted or tried to not fix this because the court can't touch it. notwithstanding whether or not the court has jurisdiction, the secretary and the board have taken actions to try to correct this issue. I hope it was clear in our pleadings that we, you know, this situation is unfortunate. It was not intended. We didn't intend to miscalculate the timeliness of these 10182s. And I'm sure that calculation errors also occur in the legacy system as well. There was just more runway to have those corrected in that process. And that's why it's important here for the board, for the veteran to be able to challenge timeliness before the board, before it gets to this court, and that kind of intermediate.
Chief Judge Bartley's question, if a prudential and informative notice to assist in navigating the different options is a euphemism for requiring additional steps to get to a final board decision, what's the board's authority for withholding decision until an additional step is completed?
Your Honor, I think, as I indicated to the Chief Judge, I don't have a great answer for that, but if the court finds that dispositive in this case, I would be happy to dig in on that and provide something supplementally. But that is the board's position is that's the structure they have to conduct that review, and it would be consistent with a veteran's one right of appeal on a determination before the agency, before it gets to this court, and in order to get a final decision of the board.
So the process that you have in place right now, explain it to me. What, someone files a 10-182 in similar circumstances to Mr. Kearns. Let's say they do it, you know, yesterday they did it.
What? Sure, all right. Are you interested in the administrative process or kind of the more legal challengeability process?
Both.
So from an administrative standpoint, that 10-182 would be submitted to the board. It would go into their intake system. And this is summarized in the board's declaration. An administrative professional would open either electronically or physically that notice, review it. If it's a 10-182, they would be tasked with determining whether it was timely or not. If it's timely, a docketing notice is sent to the veteran, consistent with whatever their election was in the modern system, evidence submission, direct appeal, hearing lane. If it's untimely, then they'll issue what is now the amended notice, which I think is probably of interest to you, Chief Judge, that says, you know, if you disagree with this letter, I believe that disagree language is still there, or that heading, you can either file an extension because it was truly untimely and you think there's good cause for the timeliness. If you think there's a calculation error, you can have it recalculated. Or if you'd like this reviewed by a VLJ, you can ask for review by a VLJ, and then they will issue an appealable decision. And I believe also there would be an appealable decision issued if there was a denial of the extension request for good cause. And if it was a calculation error, it would either, again, be denied because it was untimely, or if there was truly a calculation error, it would be docketed consistent with the timely 10-182.
So you laid out three choices. File an extension, recalculate it. Apparently an administrative person does that, or it'll go before, or you can ask for it to go before a VLJ for what we, you know, call a final board decision, an appealable decision. So what if you ask for a recalculation and they still say it's untimely? What kind of, so no VLJ has been involved yet, even though under the old system and, it would seem that there should be similar rights to appeal timeliness issues under the new system. But under this new system, so a veteran asks for a recalculation, what's going to happen?
I could just clarify one thing. I believe an extension request and a request by a VLJ would both go to a VLJ. So you would have a traditional board decision and the trappings of that cover letter order.
So it's only if you ask for a recalculation that you won't get a VLJ decision. So at what point down the recalculation route will you get an appealable VLJ decision, what you're calling an appealable VLJ decision?
My understanding is if you were to ask for a recalculation, because that's as we noted, kind of binary. It's either timely or it's not. They would either, if it was truly untimely, then they could correct that and the administrative professional could just docket the appeal as a calculation error. If it was still untimely, purely untimely, so no calculation error based on the recalculation, my understanding is they would get a very similar notice letter that then they could seek extension or a decision by a VLJ. The calculation option I would view as more informal than formal. The board tried to put that here to catch errors like Mr. Kern's experienced, where there on its face of the letter, there was a miscalculation present.
And so, okay, let's add 10 minutes to the time, Ms. Burquet. So if I ask for a recalculation, I am not going to, and they find that it's not timely, even though it may be, you admit that there was an error in this case. There could be, you know, errors in the same case, whereas that someone looks at it a second time and still wrongly says, you filed late. So if I keep asking for a recalculation, even though you're telling me that timeliness issues are appealable decisions, they will not get an appealable VLJ decision if someone asks for a recalculation.
Well, Your Honor, my hope is that the board wouldn't miscalculate the relevant timeline multiple times.
Well, that was your hope here, too, but apparently it does happen.
But we haven't identified any cases where it's been miscalculated, especially in the responses to the notice we received. They have been caught and docketed appropriately. But that is my current understanding of how the process works before the board. But if the court's concern is that recalculation request is not being done by a VLJ, I could ask the board for clarification in that regard to confirm that whether a VLJ will be handling that or whether administrative professional. I admit my understanding is that would be done more informally just by nature of the calculation request. But I'm happy to
well, it's see. Not the, it's not the recalculation that needs to be done by a board member. It's the decision post recalculation that no, you're untimely. I mean, that's you agreed with me in my first line of questioning that under 7105 B1C, that a question as to timeliness will be decided by the board. A question as to the timeliness of an NOD shall be decided by the board. That's a shall. And you agreed with me that board there meant VLJ appealable decision. It doesn't just mean board admin, you know, factotum.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think the board intends, it does happen. It's happened in these cases to miscalculate these. And so, you know, the way the letter was initially drafted and the way it's been amended with that calculation request was an attempt to try to catch these limited circumstances where there might be a miscalculation done. And again, my understanding is that would potentially be done informally, but I don't know what on the initial recalculation, but I don't know what would be happening necessarily downstream of that. And if that's, I'm happy to contact the board to seek confirmation on that if the court is interested.
I would be interested, yes, if you contact the board.
Your Honors, if there's no further questions.
I have a couple. These changes in process, however laudable and perhaps effective, don't help Mr. Kearns with respect to the decision letter that he got, the rejection letter that he got. So I think that it highlights the problem more than it may solve it for future veterans, doesn't solve it for Mr. Kearns, right?
Your Honor, just to clarify, Mr. Kearns has had his 1082 recalculated and docketed at the board, and it's currently pending decision on the merits at the board. So Mr. Kearns has been made has received a remedy here that puts him in the place where he would have had we treated his 1082 as timely initially, even the docketing position at the board. So for Mr. Kern specifically, he currently has not suffered the harm that somebody might have suffered if they hadn't had that action taken yet.
Thank you for that. The other question I have is, why doesn't the veteran's timely filing of a notice of appeal and the docketing of that appeal in our court mean the jurisdiction is here, such that the secretary had to seek remand to reconsider its March 24, 2020 finding that the veterans board appeal was untimely? Isn't that the effect of the Cerullo case?
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate that question. I think the courts, I hate to repeat it, but the court's jurisdictional statute 7252 speaks to a decision of the board. 7266 speaks to a final decision of the board. That's how this court and the Federal Circuit have interpreted that. And in the context of Cerullo, the Cerullo case, the veteran actually appealed a final decision of the board to this court, and the board wanted to take action on a motion that was filed with it while the court had jurisdiction as we understand it under 7252 over the board decision. So I think that's the key distinction between this case and Cerullo, is that in Cerullo you had a final decision of the board that was within the court's jurisdiction, and the board was trying to take action separately based on a motion there. Here it's our position that because this letter is not a decision, that the court couldn't take jurisdiction over that. And in that context, that the filing of the notice of appeal here didn't prohibit the secretary from acting given that lack of jurisdiction.
But doesn't the forum for deciding that question change and become our court and no longer the board?
Your Honor, I want to make sure I understand your question. The forum in terms of whether or not that this court has jurisdiction over that letter, or I just want to make sure I understand the question.
Right. Or any appeal from the board. So it's your position that the board can unilaterally decide that we don't have jurisdiction and take action on the case at the board level, even if there's an appeal that's been made to our court, docketed by our court, and is in process, as this one was, for 3 months.
Respectfully, I hope I can say this in the kindest possible way. We raised a jurisdictional challenge very early in this case to raise this issue, say, hey, this letter that was filed or that appellant seeks to appeal is not a decision in our view. And consistent with that position, then took actions to fix Mr. Kern's case. And hopefully that's viewed as a way to expeditiously fix a problem that's obvious. We saw that this is something, and I almost think of this almost kind of like a writ, because this was an issue that could be fixed relatively easy if raised to the secretary, and appellant chose not to pursue the writ basis, which could have either, as one of the court's orders noted, could have resulted in an appealable decision on the question, or had the secretary take some remedial action in the context of a writ to actually docket this, because on the four corners of this letter, there was a calculation error that was easily fixed by the secretary. Does that answer your question?
Not satisfactorily, but yes, it answers it.
So, Mr. Esterman, I'm trying to understand this process that you have in place now. And my uncertainty is, what is the need for the letter? Why not just give veterans who file untimely a final decision by the board that says that their appeal was filed untimely? You've mentioned several times the one review on appeal. And so is it the secretary's position that the initial review is this you know, board admin person, and then the veteran, even though they're within the appeals context already, meaning that they're already at the board has established an internal appeals process. So before you get to, even though you filed your Form 9, I'm sorry, not your Form 9, your NOD, and you're at the board, you need to do something else to get it before a board member.
Yes, sir.
Let's add 5 minutes, please, Ms. Briquet.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that there is this extra, another step that needs to happen to get that final appealable decision on timeliness. And I think you're correct to highlight that part of this is because the AMA has changed kind of the landscape and how these, where these issues are processed. And so, you know, in the AMA, the NOD and the VA-9 are kind of fused in some regard. And, you know, now the board is tasked with intaking these notices of disagreements or 10-182s or board appeal requests, however you want to characterize them. And so consistent with the process that we took in the legacy system to ensure that a veteran can seek review of that initial determination as to timeliness, which happened previously, you know, at the RO and is now happening at the board. It's our position that to give the veteran that one right of appeal on that timeliness determination is something that needs to happen now internally at the board. I understand that's kind of odd, but that's just kind of the placement of where all that processing is happening now. And so that is the system that the board and the secretary believe is now in place in the context of the AMA, given those kind of structural changes.
Right. But the difference here is that there was the right of one review on appeal. You know, obviously that's an existing right throughout, but under legacy, let's say someone filed an untimely NOD, they would get correct me if I'm wrong, they would get an appealable decision as to their untimeliness, like from the get-go down at the RO. There would be a rating adjudicator deciding you're late and here's how to challenge this decision that you were late with your NOD. Whereas now that there's an extra step where the veteran has to ask for an appeal.
Hopefully this doesn't complicate the issue, but while these are both, I'll call them both NODs, legacy AMD, AMA or modern NOD, I think the best way to think about a 10-182 or an AMA NOD is more like a VA Form 9. And so there, you know, we have a good cause analysis for extension that's similar to a VA Form 9. Whereas, you know, NOD in the context of the legacy system was more of a jurisdictional conferring, you know, document that put the appellate process in place. And so that similar change, that similar kind of action is not present in the modern system.
But
claims processing.
But if a veteran had submitted a late Form 9, then I don't think they would have gotten an administrative letter from saying that they were late. They would have gotten an appealable decision. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe under the legacy system, they would have received a decision that would have been appealable.
Yeah, so you see what my point is. There's this extra step here where a veteran has to do something, doesn't get a decision immediately, but has to take further action in order to get something that's appealable. At least that's your view of how the system should work now and does work.
Your Honor, I would argue that there was a lot of steps in the legacy system. If your NOD was determined to be untimely, then you would have to appeal that. You would get an SOC, you would file Form 9, it would eventually make its way to the board. Here it's shrunken a little bit. You know, it's streamlined in some respects. But as part of those changes, You're correct. There's this initial determination as to timeliness that needs to be challenged. In our view, it's not, a more formalistic decision as was present in the legacy system.
And it's formalistic, and more importantly, appealable. Right?
We don't disagree
you have issued the veteran something that is not, in your view, is not appealable. And it's not really clear to me why there is this extra step of something not appealable.
I see I'm about to run out of time. If I could just address your point briefly.
Yes, please add 5 minutes.
Thank you. Not to sound like a broken record, but I think there's still that intended right of appeal before the agency, which if you were able to directly appeal this letter to the court, we would view that as interlocutory in nature, right? That's the court generally doesn't recognize interlocutory appeals. And so the veteran would not have that opportunity to challenge it before the agency. And I think the ability to have issues corrected before the agency, to challenge issues within the agency, is partially to ease the burden on a veteran from coming up to the court, which can be difficult for a veteran. So allowing them the opportunity to have that issue corrected and reviewed within the agency, especially in the context of this case where there is a calculation error that could be quickly fixed on our part. I think that's something that I'm hoping the court would want to encourage rather than create kind of more process in place. And again, I understand the concern about the letter itself and the language there and maybe the lack of clarity, but that is why the board has attempted has amended that letter for clarity to make sure it's very clear to a veteran all of these options, the extension option that they have under 20.203, an option to have this recalculated, which again, we hope that the calculation errors are few and far between, but to the extent that there is one, that it can be corrected, or otherwise an ability to get a decision from a VLJ.
Thank you, Mr. Esterman. Judge Greenberg, do you have further questions?
No.
Judge Jaquith, any further questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Esterman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Luck, you may proceed.
Okay, good morning, Chief Judge Bartley, Judge Jaquith, Judge Greenberg, and may it please the court. Once again, my name is Adam Luck with Glover Luck LLP, representing veteran James Kearns, who, along with his wife, I'm happy to have watching these proceedings remotely. I just wanted to reiterate some of the undisputed facts of this case to lay out the landscape. On December 18th, 2019, Mr. Kearns received a statement of the case denying his appeals in the legacy system. And within that appeal period, he opted his claims into the AMA and then appealed to the board by filing a VA Form 10182 Notice of Disagreement. Now, as the Secretary stated, March 24th, 2020, the board dismissed his timely filed appeal by incorrectly concluding that it was untimely under the AMA, it was ineligible under the AMA, and that the appeal period in the legacy system had also passed. So Mr. Kearns appealed to this court, and then in doing so, it was discovered that what happened to Mr. Kearns was not an isolated incident, but had happened to other veterans who timely filed appeals to the board and had those appeals rejected in similar fashion to the way Mr. Kearns' appeals was rejected. And this culminated in a request for class certification and class action. The Secretary moved to dismiss the appeals, arguing that they are not final decisions from the board that are within this court's jurisdiction. And so we agree to this with the Secretary to the extent that the primary issue in this case is whether the board's March 2020 dismissal of Mr. Kearns' appeal is a final decision that's subject to the appeal to this court, with the secondary issue being whether class certification and class action are appropriate in this situation. So turning to that threshold question, Mr. Kearns asserts that the March 2020 dismissal is a decision that is within this court's jurisdiction for really three main reasons. One, it denied the appellate review that he sought. And by denying that appellate review, that December 2019 statement of the case that denied his appeals became final. And then two, it provided the reasons or basis explaining why it denied appellate review. Again, that his appeal was ineligible, that it was untimely, etc. And then three, it didn't indicate that any further action would be taken by the board or by the regional office on the appeal. And as this court noted, it shifted that responsibility over to Mr. Kearns to take additional action, to take additional steps, and actually to file a new appeal to start over to have his appeal heard. Now, all of these items, Mr. Kearns argues, satisfy the substantive requirements for a board decision that is subject to appeal in this court. And I do want to take a minute to address something that the secretary argued in his pleadings, that there was not an order attached to the March 2020 dismissal. And on that topic, Mr. Kearns asserts that that's merely a non-substantive error. And specifically, this court held in Lowingen v. Brown that the board decision in that case didn't contain an order granting or denying benefit either. And the secretary took the position that the failure to include an order was a non-substantive error. And the court acknowledged that under 38 U.S.C. 7104D, that the board decision shall include an order, but in this situation, it was nevertheless a decision capable of judicial review despite not containing an order. And one of the things that Mr. Kearns does want to highlight is the lens through which this court should view that March 2020 dismissal. So the secretary views this through the lens of a legally sophisticated representative, in that it doesn't check all the boxes for a technical decision. But really, this should be viewed through the lens of the lay veteran with no legal training, who may have never seen a board decision before, may have never seen a dismissal before. And viewing it through the lens of the lay veteran, it is clear that that March 2020 dismissal conveyed to Mr. Kearns, conveyed to the members of the class, that their appeals were ineligible and untimely and dismissed and rejected. And without any further action being taken, it's clear that that shifted the responsibility to the veteran to ask for an extension, to file a new appeal, again, to start over. And so while the secretary might be familiar with board decisions or dismissals in the traditional format, the lay veteran is not. Even lay veterans who might have received board decisions or dismissals in the legacy appeal system might not have received one in the Appeals Modernization Act system. So this might be just indicate to the lay veteran that, oh, this is something new. This is how they look now. But it is that lens, that lay veteran lens to which this should be, the March 2020 dismissals should be viewed.
So Mr. Luck, you were saying how confusing this could be for a lay veteran and that they might think they couldn't do anything about it. But I mean, the letter, the March 24, 2020 letter, which, you know, admittedly, the secretary has admitted had flaws, did have two paragraphs regarding what do I do if I disagree with this letter. And it said he could file an extension, you know, for good cause, which obviously a veteran like Mr. Kearns would not think applicable to him because he thought that because his appeal was timely. It wasn't, it didn't need an extension. And then what's the other paragraph here? Is that the only one, was that the only thing that they told him that he could file for an extension, or was there another option?
Yes, Your Honor. They instructed him that he could file an extension under the AMA if he can show good cause. The letter also noted that the deadline to appeal in the legacy system had also expired. So it instructed him ask for an extension in there and file a Form 9. And then if your Form 9 gets rejected, you can appeal that rejection up to the board. So it was really the extension with good cause for both AMA and legacy.
Okay. And Did you try anything with the board other than an appeal to the court? Did you do anything in response to this letter, like contacting the board?
No, Your Honor, because we viewed that as a final decision. And in viewing the options that were provided by the board, none of them applied to Mr. Kearns. He didn't need an extension because he timely filed his appeal. He didn't have good cause because he had notice. So to say that here are your only two options, which don't actually apply, that was really more of an illusory suggestion by the board. And so he really viewed this as no other choice but to appeal, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. And you spoke about Lonergan, which we usually use to, you know, kind of have the board make administrative corrections to its decision, like, you know, the name is wrong or something like that, that, you know, there's a middle initial missing. Is there any precedent decision from this court or the Federal Circuit that held that a notice letter was an appealable board decision? Is there any case law that you found on that other than your Lonergan reference?
I have not, Your Honor. And in this situation, we're referring to this as a notice letter, but again, we think that this satisfies all the criteria for a decision. And so really the secretary's objections to the March 2020 dismissal is purely based on format, that it wasn't drafted in the traditional format as the secretary used the phrase, and that, but substantively, and again, viewed in the lens of the lay veteran, the content and the effect of that March 2020 dismissal was the same. And so
And it's your understanding that Kenneth Arnold, who signed the letter as the vice chairman, he is a member of the board or was at the time that this letter was drafted?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's one thing that is a little perplexing about this case is the secretary's pleadings indicate that these timeliness determinations are not made by Ken Arnold. They're made by administrative professionals, I guess, to which Ken Arnold's name is affixed to them. And so under 7105, I think a member of the board is this, what's happening in these cases is the administrative professional. And then that's who's drafting these timeliness determinations and distributing them to these veterans. Now, whether they have Ken Arnold's name affixed to them or not, they're all a member of the board. And I don't think that the secretary can effectively shield itself from judicial review by saying this was an administrative professional that made this error, which the board conceded was an error, or this was Ken Arnold's error. It wasn't the board's error.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. And I do want to address something else that that relates to this court's jurisdiction, and that's the finality of this March 2020 dismissal. So as I previously stated, the March 2020 dismissal did not indicate that any further action by the board or by the regional office would be taken. It didn't indicate that there was a pending jurisdictional item that had yet to be resolved. And one thing that the secretary argued in his pleadings was that the March 2020 dismissal was merely an attempt as a notice to comply with 38 CFR 20.104C, which contains the due process notice whenever the board identifies a jurisdictional defect, or excuse me, a potential jurisdictional defect. But the word potential is defined as expressing possibility or capable of becoming actuality. And the March 2020 dismissal and those letters akin to it already made the determination as to timeliness. And even the secretary conceded that that was the initial determination of the board as to timeliness. And so it did not identify any potential jurisdictional defect. It already concluded that. Nor did it inform the veteran that he had the right to submit additional arguments or evidence or request a hearing addressing these this potential jurisdictional defect. All those actions that are required by 20.104C that indicate to the lay veteran that a decision as to jurisdiction has not been made, but will be made in the future after the veteran is afforded an opportunity to be heard. So nothing in the 2020 dismissals indicates that there's any pending unadjudicated issue that will be revisited. Instead, it conveyed to the veterans that your appeals are done, they've been closed, no action will be taken.
Well, Mr. Luck, what about Mr. Esterman's citation to the one review on appeal and statute, and that his, I guess the secretary's position is that this kind of this, I don't know, elongated process where you get an administrative letter, then you get an appealable decision if you appeal that, or, you know, if you follow up on that administrative decision to the right degree. He was referencing the fact that veterans are guaranteed, you know, one review on appeal, and that in this case, with the board making the decision as to timeliness, it would, I guess, rob the veteran of that right to have this kind of play itself out at the board level.
So what really is happening, as explained by the secretary, is the board is making two reviews on appeal. They're making this administrative determination and then shifting the responsibility to the veteran or the claimant to take additional action if dissatisfied with that administrative professional determination. And only then will it provide that one review. But as you stated earlier, this should be a situation in which that one review on appeal results in the traditional formatted decision that's dismissing, that's expressing the determination, not this initial step and then requires an initial step to get to an appealable decision. The secretary is arguing that the AMA is designed to streamline the issue, but that's not streamlining anything. It's adding steps. It's making it cumbersome for these veterans to obtain a traditionally formatted decision. And really in this context, the board should be issuing these traditionally formatted determinations as to timeliness, so, and attaching full appellate rights so that the veterans know what their options are. And one of those being the ability to appeal to court. This court just had a similar case involving a traditionally formatted dismissal in Hall v. McDonough. And the secretary did not dispute that the board decision in that case was subject to judicial review. Yet, conversely, veterans like Mr. Kearns and the other veterans of the class are receiving these non-traditionally formatted dismissal letters that the secretary is arguing is not subject to judicial review. But if Mr. Kearns had been as lucky as the veteran in Mr. Hall's case, he would have been able to appeal with no objection from the secretary. And so it is treating these similarly situated veterans differently. That is really one of the focal points of this case. They should be issuing out the traditionally formatted appealable decision with attaching appellate rights from the get-go, not a first initial step that requires additional action. We've done away with that. That's the NOD in the legacy system that was perfected with a Form 9. You know, the secretary sought to get away from the cumbersomeness of the legacy system to streamline under the AMA, and it has done everything but in this situation.
And so in this, regardless what I might have been arguing or saying to Mr. Esterman, where is the review here then, in terms of the one review on appeal? Where is the review here if the board makes the initial decision. The board member makes the initial decision as to timeliness. It's just something that kind of went by the wayside in this particular respect once the AMA was adopted. Is that your take on it?
It's my understanding from the pleadings and from the secretary's testimony that one review on appeal is happening through these administrative professionals. And as discussed in the pleadings, the first step in appellate review is determining jurisdiction. And so it appears that these administrative professionals are satisfying or trying to adjudicate that first step as to jurisdiction.
If I may interrupt, who are these so-called administrative professionals? What's their training? What's their background? What's their experience? How do we know they're doing a good job? Obviously not from this case. The secretary has had to correct the letter. We don't know how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of people are involved here.
I completely agree, Your Honor. It is unclear from the secretary's pleadings what training these administrative professionals have and what capacity they're truly acting. And all we know from the secretary's pleadings is that a special team was created to review jurisdictional determinations.
Well, I mean, if Mr. Arnold, what is he, an assistant secretary? No, he's the vice chairman of the board. Isn't he a very high up official in the VA structure? He's signing the letters. He either has confidence in the substance of the decision represented by the letter. And if so, why shouldn't we treat this as the end of the line and let why aren't we the determinators of our jurisdiction? Why would we want to leave it to the board?
Absolutely. I believe this court is the determinator of its jurisdiction. And hence, when the notice of appeal to this court is filed, jurisdiction conveys to this court, and it's up to this court to determine whether it has jurisdiction properly or not. It is not up to the board, after a notice of appeal has been filed to this court, to then retract and pick and choose which cases it wants to allow this court to hear. So, for example, if there is an issue that the secretary does not want addressed by this court, allowing the board to quickly satisfy and rob this court of its jurisdiction, it allows the court to evade that judicial review.
Yeah, it's sort of similar, is it not, to picking off a legitimate member of the class, satisfying their case, and therefore denying the court jurisdiction, because by way
absolutely,
of
example,
the class doesn't exist. Is that what happened here?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that really is what has been happening so far in this case, is the secretary has gone through all of the previous cases that were filed in this court and has feverishly settled them, docketed them, and attempted to moot them out in an attempt to not let this case go forward. And again, the secretary's efforts, I completely understand, are appreciated to resolve this quickly, but nevertheless, it needs permission from the court in order to take these actions. And it's not getting so. In the other case,
go ahead.
In the other cases that were filed, the secretary obtained permission from this court. So whenever those cases were settled, they were disposed of in a joint termination and settlement agreement so that the board could take the corrective action. And here, the secretary has not done so for Mr. Kearns' case.
Why do you imagine that's so? Because you two haven't agreed? You're implying that the secretary has acknowledged our jurisdiction by accepting an order from the court allowing the secretary to do what they've done in these other cases. Is that your argument?
I believe this court has jurisdiction by virtue of filing a notice of appeal to this court, and that it has to make that jurisdictional determination before the board is allowed to determine that the court does not have jurisdiction.
All right. I get your position.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Mr. Luck, what is or was the adverse effect on Mr. Kearns that makes this a justiciable case or controversy now?
Yes, Your Honor. So at the time this case was filed, Mr. Kearns had received the March 24th, 2020 dismissal letter, and his appeal had not been docketed. No action had been taken. It was effectively dismissed. As this case proceeded and other cases were filed in similar situations, the secretary contacted the board and instructed it to docket Mr. Kearns' appeal. The board issued a letter admitting it administratively erred, stating that it had docketed Mr. Kearns' appeal and that it extended his evidentiary window because he filed his appeal in the 90-day evidence lane. In pleadings, we have conceded that the docketing with the proper evidentiary window has satisfied Mr. Kearns's his appeal, thus to moot out any case of controversy. But so at the time, he did suffer that harm. It has since been remedied by the board, albeit without permission from this court. That being said, the other members of the class, which the secretary has not identified, they're still suffering that harm, Your Honor. And in that context, I do want to note that the secretary has taken the position that it's unable to locate the other class members, which have received these similarly drafted dismissals. And in that context, the pleading and the secretary's arguments both concede that the secretary is able, the board is able to locate these people. It's not a situation that they cannot. It's a situation that they don't want to, because their argument is that it's too cumbersome, it's too labor intensive, given the constraints of their electronic filing systems. But as the secretary has argued and as he has stated in his pleadings, they can go through the 10182 notice of disagreements that have received and check each one of those to see who has been erroneously dismissed or improperly dismissed and who has not. So this isn't a situation where they cannot locate them. They certainly can, and the secretary has conceded as much. So one of the other things that I think has been somewhat muted in the pleadings in this case is that and I touched on it earlier, is that veterans like Mr. Kearns, veterans, the class members in this case, are receiving these non-traditional formatted dismissals through this, I guess we'll call it an intermediate step in the secretary's jurisdictional review process, I suppose. And they're receiving these non-traditionally formatted dismissals, despite the board's ability to issue them in a more format, more traditional format that is subject to appeal, that has appellate rights attached, that the secretary is not disputed is subject to this court's jurisdiction. And so, again, treating these similarly situated veterans and claimants differently is one of the other problems that's happening in this case. They need to issue these dismissals the same way it's issuing any other dismissal for any other reason. And I do think it's clear from the multiple cases that were filed, from the secretary's concessions, that the dismissal that Mr. Kearns received in this case is not unique to him or an isolated incident. And whether the error is due to a calculation error or some other administrative professional error, the result is the same, that it is conveyed to these veterans that their timely filed eligible appeals were dismissed and no action would be taken on them.
Mr. Luck, as to your, I wanted to move on to the class question here. So you have defined the class as claimants who have received or will receive the same or substantially similar letter from the board, not from a board member, of course, but from the board that Kearns did, letters denying appellate eligibility or jurisdiction under the AMA, and you're including legacy as well, for issues timely appealed via the VA Form 10-182. Now, doesn't that characterization of the class require a lot of fact-finding? And in particular, your inclusion of the word of the timely appealed. I mean, I don't know. I mean, veterans could be denied or found untimely for a variety of reasons. Here, it was a miscalculation in your case, but I mean, there could be all kinds of different factual situations here. So how can you expect, it seems like you want a class that would require VA or us to do a lot of fact finding about who was timely or untimely. And that's kind of beyond the scope of a class. I mean, you don't want a class where you have to do all kinds of calculations first, factual determinations to determine who falls into the class.
I understand, Your Honor. And just to start out my response, the court does have the authority to rephrase and define the class as it does see fit. But to your question, Mr. Honor,
I know we do. And I know we did that in Godsey and perhaps one other case, but do you have a characterization that would be more tailored that would work here?
Well, one of the reasons why that class was defined as such, is
let's add 10 minutes, Ms. Burkett. Thank you.
Is one of the issues that we've touched on a little bit earlier when we're talking about the way in which these veterans and claimants had their appeals dismissed through this non-traditional format that did not attach appellate rights, that that signaled to the veterans that their appeals were done for whatever reason, but did not signal to the veterans that they could appeal these final determinations to the court. And so I acknowledge that that those class members who fall outside of the facially evident miscalculation errors might require some additional fact finding. It is also the way it is that those dismissals from the board should have been phrased in the traditional format that allow all of those recipients to be able to receive, to be able to appeal to the court, and not to just suffer the consequences of what the secretary is categorizing as an unappealable decision determination as to the board's jurisdiction. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, but I did ask how you would characterize it more narrowly.
Thank you for reminding me. So in order to determine, the proper, more narrow definition of the class, I would have to say the class would be defined as the recipients of these miscalculation errors that were distributed by these administrative professionals. Let me think about that one, Your Honor. Because again, there's the underlying issue of the way in which these appeals were dismissed that is also at issue. So I see the struggle with not only defining the issues or the reasons, I guess, that the appeals were dismissed, but also the way in which they were dismissed. So it's a twofold issue from our standpoint. And again, the secretary has conceded that the calculation or miscalculations were due to administrative error and a willingness to go back and review those determinations. And the class vehicle is really the only way to allow the secretary or to, I guess, force the secretary to review, to find all those veterans and claimants who have been improperly dismissed.
And does Mr. Kearns have any other claims pending right now before VA down below the board at the AOJ level?
He does, Your Honor. He has these the claims that were initially dismissed in the March 2020 letter. As the secretary has stated, the board has since redocketed those appeals. And then those are currently pending an adjudication. And he most recently, earlier this year, received adjudication on some other pending claims that he had had.
Oh, down at the AOJ level?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
To pick up the secretary in this case, since we're on the topic of the class certification and class action, has taken sua sponte these notice steps and defined the timeline in which the errors could have happened. But one thing the secretary is trying to avoid is judicial oversight in treating this as like a quasi class, whether that notice provided by the secretary was adequate, whether its definition of when these errors could have occurred or what is encompassed in these or when these errors were or notice letters were issued. But that is subject to dispute, and that's why judicial oversight in this class is appropriate. And a perfect example of that is the secretary has, the secretary has argued that, or excuse me, published in his notice that any dismissal similar fashion to Mr. Kearns's dismissal that was received February 19th, 2019, when the AMA was promulgated or became effective, all the way through March 2021. But prior to February 19th, 2019, the VA operated the Rapid Appeals Modernization Program, the RAMP program, which operated under AMA rules and in which veterans could appeal to the board through what was a modified statement in support of claim, which now became the 101A2. So the board could have also improperly dismissed those appeals under the RAMP program as well. But for some reason, the secretary did not include that in the notice. And so judicial oversight is necessary here to make sure that the members of this class are being properly addressed and properly remedied. And I also think, Your Honor, that as conceded by the secretary, this wasn't an isolated incident to Mr. Kearns. The secretary is maintaining that same defense in each of this, each of these cases that were filed to the court in Mr. Kearns's case, that these are not appealable decisions, while simultaneously treating this remedy as a class, just without judicial oversight. And in doing so, the secretary is trying to have his cake and eat it too, so to speak. So on the one hand, the secretary is arguing that these are non-final notice letters, but then on the other hand, has created this deadline of March 1st, 2022, through which, unless the recipient of one of those letters contacts the board, no further action will be taken. But if it's a pending appeal, because this is a non-final decision, the secretary cannot arbitrarily create a March 1st, 2022 deadline to which that appeal just automatically becomes final for no reason, because the claimants, the class members, did not take additional action. And so, again, this is a situation where class certification and class action are necessary to locate and remedy these deserving individuals. I do see that my time is winding down. I will just a final closing thought. Unless there are any further questions, I'm happy to answer. I will say the secretary wants to deny Mr. Kearns' request for class certification and class action, despite being unwilling to determine how many claimants have been adversely affected by these same dismissals that Mr. Kearns received. Just really treating these deserving claimants as small people with small claims that aren't worth the secretary's efforts to locate and to resolve. So we do respectfully ask the court to deny the secretary's motion to dismiss and to grant class certification and class action. And I don't have...
Judge Greenberg, do you have any further questions?
Nothing further.
And Judge Jaquith?
No, thank you, Chief Judge Barley.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Locke. And Mr. Esterman, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have a ton of time here, so I'd like to make three quick primary points and maybe some ancillary points if time allows. The first point I'd like to make is that in response to the Chief Judge's concern about 19.34, was able to confirm that there is no comparable 19.34 under the AMA regs. 20.203 is now the regulation that governs NODs. So that's the only thing I can point to in response to your question during my opening. The second point I'd like to make is about the parallel process between the legacy and the AMA system. There's these comments about there being this extra step in the process, and I'd just like to clarify that whether it was in the legacy system or the AMA system, a veteran always had to challenge a timeliness determination to move that challenge forward. Whether that was to challenge it under the legacy system or those procedures, in our view, is that no differently under the AMA, that this initial determination needs to be challenged to get to an appealable decision to put it within the court's jurisdiction here. The last primary point I'd like to make is, appellant refers to these letters as dismissals. And I'd like to clarify that these letters, I think, are important claims processing event, but they're not jurisdictional determinations. So an administrative professional is not making a jurisdictional determination such that this is subject to 20.104C. And I think that is a point I'd like to clarify from our pleadings. We indicated that we weren't sure if 20.104C applies here. But I think more clearly, these are not jurisdictional determinations for a few reasons. And I think the primary reason is that you can seek an extension for good cause based on the timeliness of your file 10-182. And consistent with Henderson, anytime there's a possible extension for good cause, that takes it kind of out of the jurisdictional realm and puts it more in terms of the claims processing realm. So this letter isn't a dismissal. It doesn't use language that indicates that it's a dismissal. It merely says that your 10-182 was untimely such that it could not be processed under the modern system.
Just a minute. Who are these administrative professionals? Who are they? How many of them are there? How many cases do they decide? What's the basis for their case determination of timeliness?
Your Honor, unfortunately, I don't know how many there are or their determination is timeless. My understanding from the declaration and my discussions from the board is that these are administrative professionals.
But who are they? What's their background? Are they lawyers?
They are not. I don't want to overgeneralize. I guess lawyers could be doing a number of jobs, but these are not the counsel at the board.
Well, what do they do in order to calculate that the veteran, this is a lay veteran, He's not a lawyer, not a professional with a veteran service organization. How do these so-called administrative professionals determine that the veteran has made an untimely submission?
Your Honor,
what do they do?
Your Honor, I would just refer you to the declaration, which lays out the board's process for doing this. These administrative professionals open the mail, see that you have a Time 182, make a kind of initial determination to as whether this is timely or not, whether it's 60 days or a year or whatever in the context of the relevant timeline for that submission, and then either docket it, send out the docketing notice, which is, in our view, an administrative task, and then or send out this letter just saying that this is untimely and here are your options if you disagree with the letter.
I know, but here we have, you have acknowledged that a mistake was made, at least here, and there are others that I think you've acknowledged or at least implied that there are others out there that you haven't been able to determine. So doesn't that suggest there's something wrong with the system that you are hanging your hat entirely on, that the secretary is relying on and saying, don't bother as a court in intervening. We can handle this. You haven't so far, have you?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree in that regard. We have, for the cases that have been identified, we've come up with a process to attempt to identify additional veterans that may have had this issue. And, you know, in a positive way, Mr. Kern's bringing this issue to our attention did set off a number of these events to make sure that these calculation issues are corrected when found, or that this could possibly be an issue. But ultimately, these administrative professionals are just trying to figure out, are calculating 60 days, probably no different than, I see my time is up.
Let's add 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's the actual act that these administrative professionals are taking is probably no different than what my friend Mr. Luck and I are doing in calculating a deadline before this court. They're calculating 60 days a year. And unfortunately, there's human error in part of that, as evidenced by the number of 7-day orders this court issues every day. And so this was a human error. We were seeking to correct it. And I think I hope, again, that the actions that we've taken in this case have shown how seriously we're taking this and attempting to resolve this. Just the barrier that we see in the context of this case is the legal issue of jurisdiction, and our view that these letters are not decisions.
Mr. Esterman, let me just go back to, you said you always, under the old system, you always had to challenge a timeliness determination. But the real question is whether the determination that was made was appealable in and of itself. It was, correct? So that's the important distinction. It's not whether there's an extra step here. It's that the step here is one of the decisions that you're issuing here is essentially what you're saying is not challengeable by.
No, Your Honor, I'm glad you said that, because I think we might be speaking past each other. What I'm saying is that under both systems, there is an initial determination as to timeliness. And if you disagree with that, you have to challenge it to put it, to kind of get that appellate review kicked off, right? There was a different process under a different but parallel process in the legacy system. And all we're saying here is this letter is not the final appealable decision of the board on the question of timeliness. That just requires a challenge to be made to that initial determination, which will then get you to a letter that would be appealable to this court. So hopefully that clarifies. We're not talking about extra steps. Actually, I think the AMA process is more streamlined. I'm sorry, I see I'm about to lose my time again, but that is what's going on in the system.
Thank you, Mr. Esterman. Judge Greenberg, do you have any further questions? No. And Judge Jaquith?
No, I don't. Thank you.
And Your Honor, if I may just briefly conclude to put our position on the record, that we just ask the court to dismiss this appeal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction and find that the request for class action is moot by extent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Esterman. And the court would like to thank both parties for their arguments. The case is submitted for consideration.
Court is in recess.